Coming up in Cambodia, the first trial at last of a Khmer Rouge leader, one of those responsible for the torturing and killing of perhaps 2 million Cambodians in the 1970s.
We treated them as if they were already dead. I allowed 4 torture methods.
Also, spiritual direction, helping locate God's role in everyday life, even in loneliness.
You know, I really see what abandonment looks like in a way.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Welcome, I'm Bob Abernethy. It's good to have you with us. Supreme Court nominee Elena Kagan made the rounds in Washington this week, introducing herself to the senators who will vote on her confirmation as the newest justice on the High Court. Special interest groups, many of them religious, are already urging specific lines of questioning for the upcoming hearings. If she's confirmed, Kagan would become the 3rd Jewish justice and the 3rd woman on the current court.
A court that would be more inclusive, more representative, more reflective of us as people than ever before.
Kagan's confirmation would also mean that for the first time in American history, the Supreme Court would have no Protestants. Does this matter? If so, what does it say about the place of Protestantism in America today? Joining me is Kim Lawton, our managing editor. Kim, I want to have a little discussion about this. People are saying, Protestants are saying, well, yes, this is a big symbol, and they're sad about it, of a decline of Protestant influence in this country. But at the same time, I hear other people saying it's really good news because it is a symbol of how far the country has come in overcoming the anti-Catholic and anti-Jewish prejudice that existed for so long, still exists, but there's been a lot of progress made on that. And they also say it matters a lot more what somebody thinks, a Supreme Court justice thinks on a particular issue, than what kind of religious label that person wears. You hear that?
Well, it is interesting. I mean, nobody's saying that she shouldn't be confirmed because it throws the religious balance of the court out or anything like that. But it has been a very interesting moment to take stock of this change in our society. But yeah, what I'm hearing from people, what I heard from one Protestant pastor this week was he said to me, I'm less concerned about her religious affiliation than I am about how she's going to vote on, for example, some of the religion cases. And certainly that those ideas of the separation of church and state and what kind of relationship the government and religion should have, that's been very controversial. There have been some very close decisions in the court. And so what she thinks about that, for example, is going to have a big impact no matter what kind of religious label she carries.
Yeah. There's also this idea that has been spoken of this week as sometimes about a Protestant worldview. And how it's important. Protestants, after all, are half the country, 51%, but still pretty close to half, that there is such a thing as a Protestant worldview and that this needs to be represented on the court. But is there such a thing as a Protestant worldview anymore?
Well, that's been really interesting for me this week to watch or to read what some people are saying just in terms of that notion. Of course, people's faith, their beliefs affect their worldview, affect how they look at things, their values. But is there a uniquely Protestant worldview in this kind of situation? There are certainly a lot of different kinds of Protestants. And even when the court had all Protestants, they didn't have all unanimous decisions. So I do think it's been an interesting question that's been raised.
And it doesn't mean that there can't ever in the future be another Protestant justice.
Well, certainly the Protestant influence in America is not going anywhere. I mean, our president is Protestant. We've only had one non-Protestant president. The majority of the U.S. Congress is Protestant. Protestants still are a vibrant community in this country and still very influential. But things are different than they used to be.
Kim Lawton, many thanks. In other news, Pope Benedict XVI condemned the church's clergy sex abuse scandal in his strongest language yet on that subject. As he traveled to Portugal, the Pope called the sex abuse crisis the greatest persecution of the church, which he said was brought about by sins within the church. Benedict said the church needs penance and purification. While in Portugal, the Pope celebrated Mass before nearly 500,000 worshipers gathered at the shrine at Fatima. Benedict's visit marked the anniversary of the event there in 1917 when three children reported seeing apparitions of the Virgin Mary. As leaking oil continues to pollute the Gulf of Mexico, a major religious leader has condemned the spill as a sin against humanity, all living things, and God. Ecumenical Patriarch Bartholomew, spiritual leader of the world's 250 million Eastern Orthodox Christians, urged prayers for an effective response. Bartholomew is often called the Green Patriarch for his environmental activism. Last fall, he visited the Gulf Coast region to encourage better stewardship of the world's waters. An historic and controversial occasion for the worldwide Anglican Communion this weekend as the Episcopal Diocese of Los Angeles consecrates Mary Glasspool as the church's first bishop who is openly lesbian. Because of bitter divisions after the 2003 consecration of Bishop Gene Robinson of New Hampshire, international Anglican leaders had asked the U.S. Episcopal Church not to elect any more gay bishops. But last summer, delegates at the Episcopal General Convention voted to move ahead in what they said was the direction they believed God was calling them, opening the way for Glasspool's election. The cross at the center of a recent Supreme Court case has been stolen from the Mojave National Preserve in California. The cross was erected in 1934 to honor American veterans, but later became central to a legal dispute over separation of church and state. Last month, the Supreme Court ruled that the cross could remain on private land that was once federal property, while a lower court reviews the cross's future. A coalition of evangelical leaders launched a new campaign this week urging Congress to pass bipartisan immigration reform. The group included some who are often considered politically conservative, such as Richard Land, a key leader in the Southern Baptist Convention. In a full-page ad in a Capitol Hill publication, the evangelical group said current immigration policy has created a moral crisis. In Sweden, an artist who had offended Muslims by depicting the Prophet Muhammad as a dog was attacked during a public lecture at Uppsala University, one of Europe's most prominent institutions. The violence broke out while Lars Vilks was speaking about the limits of artistic freedom. He had also shown a film depicting the Prophet entering a gay bar. Vilks sustained only minor injuries, but the incident has reignited heated debate about the boundaries between free speech and religious sensitivity. The famous Oberammergau Passion Play opens this weekend in Germany. The dramatic portrayal of the events leading to Jesus' crucifixion has been staged there once every decade since 1634. Many in the Jewish community have long complained about how the play portrays Jews. Leaders of the Anti-Defamation League say this year's Passion Play still has what they called hostile stereotypes of Jews and Judaism, but they say they are pleased to see some improvements, including showing that Jesus was Jewish. Next month in Cambodia, an international court is expected to rule in the long-delayed trial of one of the Khmer Rouge leaders responsible for the torture and killing of perhaps 2 million people in the 1970s. This first trial is an attempt at justice, of course. It's also a nationwide campaign to teach the younger generations what happened so it can't happen again. Fred DeSam Lazaro reports from Phnom Penh.
To the world outside, Cambodia may be best known for its killing fields. A quarter of this country's population perished during the genocidal Khmer Rouge reign in the 1970s, some 2 million people.
Hello, and welcome to the 22nd program in our series, Doik on Trial.
3 decades later, Cambodians have been able to tune in to the first Khmer Rouge trial. It may seem so little, so late, but supporters say the International Tribunal could help this country finally move on, help shed light on a period most know little about. 2/3 of today's Cambodians weren't even born during the Khmer Rouge years.
We treated them as if they were already dead. I allowed 4 torture methods.
Kang Gyuk Yav, better known as Comrade Doik, is the first to stand trial. He was commander of the notorious Tol Sleng prison. Under his watch, at least 14,000 men, women, and children were photographed and documented in a macabre administrative process. They were then tortured and killed. Cham Mei was one of only 7 prisoners to survive. He finally had his day in court, recalling the torture he suffered as the man who now has admitted responsibility and, quote, heartfelt sorrow, looked on.
On the 10th day, they electrocuted me. Every time I think of the Khmer Rouge, I think of my wife and children.
Cham survived because he was a mechanic with skills the Khmer Rouge needed for fixing sewing machines. Today, ironically, he earns a living giving guided tours of the prison, which is now a museum.
This woman's husband was a Khmer Rouge soldier. He was killed, and they arrested her.
On this day, Chum told his story to Eric Stover, a California-based human rights activist who's studying the impact of international courts on societies in general and on individual victims.
One of the things I think people will be looking at is to make sure that somebody who is responsible, like Doik was, for up to 12, 13, 14,000 deaths, that his sentence reflects the gravity of those crimes.
But in a land unfamiliar with the ways of the tribunal, some people, especially survivors like Van Nath, think it's too lenient. His life was spared so he could paint portraits of Pol Pot, the Khmer Rouge leader. He now sells paintings of his painful memories.
So everyone was blindfolded when they were taken into Tol Sleng.
Van Nath says testifying at Doik's trial made him angry at the cross-examination and at seeing how well the defendant seemed to be treated.
It was just like a shock when I go there to the court and see him. When I tell them the truth, they doubt me, ask me a lot of questions. I don't feel the trust when I tell them, and that makes me feel bad. It seems like the accused person has more rights than the civil parties do, and I'm really not satisfied with that.
Many also are dissatisfied with the slow pace of justice. It was delayed for years by Cold War politics and a reluctant Cambodian government that still has former members of the Khmer Rouge in it, though none was senior enough to stand trial. Negotiations led to a court which has 2 international and 3 Cambodian justices. It will try only a handful of prominent surviving Khmer Rouge leaders.
The Cambodian government itself was not that in favor of this court. Even the negotiations to create it took a long period of time. We say that with evidence, over time, evidence loses its value. You're 30 years later, people's memories have been, people forgotten, people have died. So going after those most responsible is really all you're going to get at this point.
Justice delayed may be justice denied for many victims, but Chum Sirath, who started a group called the Victims Association, says despite the limited number of defendants, the court sends an important message.
If we can have a bigger number, more people, it would be better. But if not, it's better than nothing. Even after 35 years, when you commit a crime, there will be people who try to put you to take you into account. This is one of the lessons that young generation can learn.
Eric Stover is among those who've pushed the court itself to teach some of those lessons, a role courts don't usually take on.
I don't think any court should be expected to be a social engineering institution. But what we can expect from them is that they should have vigorous programs that try to go out into the population and describe what they're doing, why they're doing it, and what their limitations are.
He says after a slow start, the court did launch outreach programs. Twice a week, buses have brought in thousands of Cambodians on field trips. I asked this group of visitors how many had ever heard of the court before coming here. A weekly television program during the trial brought the court a much larger audience.
Now we're going to see a selection of evidence given to the court about some of the crimes with which Doik has been charged.
Viewers should be aware that some, but not all, of the stories told here were denied by Doik.
Matthew Robinson produced the series with grants from Western donors.
We had to devise a language and to base our understanding of what was going on in the court that would be intelligible to people whose basic knowledge of legal proceedings, indeed court proceedings, is minimal indeed.
Thanks to everyone here for this discussion of Doik's trial.
We hope that this will encourage you at home to talk together about this topic, so vital to Cambodia's future well-being and progress.
The program has also encouraged dialogue between survivors and a younger generation that has heard only whispers about the atrocities.
Anybody from 25 down are not so much skeptical about it, but they lack knowledge. And parents seem to be reluctant, maybe even embarrassed, to talk about what happened to them.
Yuk Chang wants to make sure young people get the knowledge they need, even if their parents won't talk about it. He's director of the Cambodia Documentation Center, which has published a textbook that is now being provided to 1 million Cambodian students.
They never learned about this, but they heard about this.
Right now, for the first time in 30 years, from grade 9 to 12, also the foundation year of every single university, allowed to study the Khmer Rouge history. And education is very important in terms of preventing genocide in the future. It's all about the future.
And even though the Cambodian tribunals may be years late, Eric Stover says that's not historically unusual.
The interesting thing is President Chirac in France was 55 years later, after the Holocaust, that he actually apologized for the French police sending off Jews to be sent to the concentration camps. So one of the things we have to learn is when mass violence hits a country, a society, and tears it apart, it takes a long time for it to repair itself.
The Cambodia Tribunal's next case, a joint trial of four elderly former Khmer Rouge officers, is expected to begin in 2012. For Religion and Ethics News Weekly, this is Fred DeSamlazaro in Phnom Penh.
On our calendar, the Jewish holiday of Shavuot begins at sundown on Tuesday. Shavuot commemorates the giving of the Torah to Moses on Mount Sinai. Some Jews gather in synagogues and homes to study the Torah all night long. From time to time on this program, we've referred to spiritual direction and spiritual directors. Recently, the Shalem Institute for Spiritual Formation in Washington gave us permission to record a spiritual direction session with two of its most experienced directors, one seeking the help of the other. That is not unusual, they say, like one doctor treating another. Spiritual directors say what they do is more like prayer than therapy, not so much counseling as helping people discern God's presence in their lives. Every session is probably different, but this is what happened in the conversation we recorded. In Northern Virginia, about a mile from the Pentagon, Bill Dietrich, a Quaker, came to the home of Gene Sweeney, a Catholic, who had a concern. I asked Bill to define spiritual direction. He likened it to being a midwife.
One who accompanies and is present to another as they discern how God is moving in their lives. We often say that spiritual direction really is prayer. Nothing more, nothing less.
Bill's opening prayer with Gene was about surrendering to God.
Be no more than God hath made thee. Give over thine own running. Give over thine own willing. Give over thine own desiring to know or to be anything.
It's perfect for today.
Jean is the youngest of five sisters. The oldest, Rocky, now 80, is in a nursing home suffering from dementia. Jean had just been to visit her.
Here we would be standing in front of the elevator, and she could not decide to press the button. And when we got in the elevator, we're on the second floor, she could not figure out that she would hit the button for first floor. Sometimes she'd do it with two hands. And she looks 20 years old all of a sudden, you know. So I am watching this enormous loss.
The loss of Rocky's powers and companionship, and also Jean's sense of the loss that might be ahead for her.
We don't know what's in front of us, but I'd like to believe I could just give it over somehow. But do I want to live that way? No way.
Do you see God working in Rocky's life now?
It's a good question. You know, I really see what abandonment looks like in a way. Life goes on without us, and that's what I see for Rocky in some ways. Her kids they have lives and children, and it goes on, you know? Yeah. And I thought, you know, well, Jesus felt abandoned, you know? Yeah. I mean, I think would you say that?
Yeah.
To feel abandoned? You stop working and you go on and life goes on.
It does. It does.
I guess my own desire for myself, and actually even for Rocky, I wish she was just having a little more fun in the midst of it, you know? I think that's what I want, that if I surrender to that moment, this is what is, could I have a good time too? I want people to not be afraid to come near the abandoned one.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Jean read a prayer she likes.
Give me only your love and your grace. That's enough for me.
What if we can't feel the love?
Well, I hate that, for God's sakes. I know from the scriptures and from people that actually does happen. No, I don't want that. There's plenty of people that do not feel the love, and they have loved. They have been people of love.
Mm-hmm. And you're being that person of love for Rocky.
Yeah. It did feel like precious in the moment time.
Mm-hmm. Bill offered a prayer for Jean.
God, keep me rooted in your love in this moment, that I might trust that others will convey and carry your love to me in the times when I can't feel it, as I hope to be the bearer of that love to those who can't feel it in this moment.
Amen. Dear Bill, thank you. Who knew?
Thank you.
Who knew?
Afterwards, Bill said he had sensed God's presence with them. Jean said she'd been helped. We'd worried that cameras and lights might be distractions, but both Bill and Jean said what happened felt to them fully authentic. Jean also said everyone has a story about their spiritual life. All they need, she said, is for someone to ask them to tell it. That's our program for now. I'm Bob Abernethy. We'd like to hear from you. You can follow us on our Facebook page. We also have much more on our website. You can comment on all our stories and share them. Audio and video podcasts are also available. Join us at pbs.org. As we leave you, more scenes from Pope Benedict XVI's pilgrimage to Portugal.
Major funding for Religion and Ethics News Weekly is provided by the Lilly Endowment, an Indianapolis-based private family foundation dedicated to its founders' interest in religion, community development, and education. Additional funding by Mutual of America, designing customized individual and group retirement products. That's why we're yourretirementcompany.com. Also by the Henry Luce Foundation and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Be More. PBS.